The next presenter is Dan O'Hara. He is a literary critic as well, currently at NCH. He taught me, for example, how to read. I'm sure Julius owes him some of that as well. And so he's been in Germany for a couple of years in between. He's interested in American literatures, but he's also into the philosophy of technology and virtual futures and these sort of things. And I'm sure we are. His presentation has no title that I can remember. So it's going to be there's something with aesthetics of the evolutionary forum as conceived by McCarthy. But please join me in welcoming Dan.
Thank you, Katya, and thank you, Patrick, for inviting me. There is a title, I can't remember what it is either. I'm going to take a fairly elliptical route into the concerns expressed in McCarthy's essay by beginning with an extract, which is number one on this sheet, a piece of fiction. It's not by McCarthy. I'll tell you who it's by afterwards. I am choosing this because it affords me a relatively accessible, simple way to talk about things I want to talk about to a general audience, not all of whom are literary critics. I am, of course, as I am talking about this, actually thinking about McCarthy. So I'd like to ask you to be kind of suspending these kind of parallel possibilities in your mind. I will then later on show you an extract from McCarthy, which parallels this one, and we'll go back and forth. Double helix style. So, this extract depicts a man. He's in that famous position of waking up in a hospital. He does not know who he is. He doesn't know how he got there. The muttering was indistinct. It crept down the dark ward, forcing itself upon the man who lay in the patch of light at the far end of the vast room. It was a pleasant muttering. It made a reassuring undercurrent below the worry, that terrifying anxiety which was thrusting icy fingers deep into his diaphragm. He tried to concentrate on the muttering. Mercifully, it was recognizable. There were two distinct voices, and when he could catch them, the words meant something. That was good. That was hopeful. In a little while, the words might start connecting, and then, please God, he would learn something, and this appalling fear would recede. Now, what is happening here? What's being depicted? What state of mind? What train of thought? At first, this man is only just conscious. He can recognize darkness and light. He experiences his own instinctive emotions, a severe case of fight or flight response. He can distinguish meaningful sound from non-meaningful sound, and he can ascribe an emotional value to the former. That was good. That was hopeful. And he can identify human conversation, though without understanding it. The free indirect discourse employed here is only in one place, please God. A direct reproduction of this man's interior thought processes. And even in this case, the invocation is an instinctive one, which represents less an exact interior phrasing than a defined sentiment. We are being shown, by the use of the narrative method normally used for direct representation of a character's thoughts within the context of an extra diegetic narration, the thoughts of a character who is not thinking in verbal language. Now, as somebody, Julius, mentioned, Annie Dillard has said, and I'm going to paraphrase her inelegantly, I apologize for that, conscious brings us to the present, but self-conscious brings us away. Dillard is thinking of the situation of the writer, able to write only when free of self-consciousness, but the paradox applies more generally as a topic of writing. It is the paradox of perspective, one which is a major concern in fiction of the 20th century, and one which, of all literary forms, narrative fiction is perhaps uniquely fitted to examine Kafka, Beckett, Pynchon, Ballard, of course McCarthy, have all concerned themselves with the pre-lingual consciousness. And yet the way in which self-consciousness suddenly divides the self, yet their depictions of such consciousnesses are often seen as anomalous in literary criticism, anomalous cases. There's also often a firm connection with literary depictions of schizophrenia and other states of mental instability or altered consciousness. Yet we might better understand such fictions by reading them as examinations of this paradox. Arto's mysterious maxim, I is another, might very well be read as a description of this paradox. It is the use of the third person verbal form, is, which hints that this issue is not really to do with self or with others, but with understanding of the relations between conscious and self-conscious. To come back to this passage, the man here is brought to the present, to his present, by pain, anxiety, and awareness, all primal qualities. As he begins to recognize that language is happening, the language of others, which he seems to lack at present, he becomes also aware of himself and the fact that the to and fro of his emotional response between worry and reassurance can somehow be palliated and controlled by the mastering of language. It's an ancient story. The Adamic loss of innocence traded for experience, the loss of the blithe spirit for the self-conscious one, the loss of the pure body for the knowledge of nakedness, and the loss of oneness with God for the merely approximate substitute of language. At present for this character, the words do not connect to each other. What is absent in his apprehension, a lovely suitable word here, apprehend, to grasp and to fear at the same time. What is absent is a grasp of abstract relations, the connections between words and words, or words and meaning, or words and things. He cannot create a narrative from his experience, even as he experiences. Again, Annie Dillard, in her wonderful short book, The Writing Life, advises the writer, as though she is wielding an axe, aim for the chopping block. If you aim for the wood, you will have nothing. Aim past the wood, aim through the wood, aim for the chopping block. Her parable is to do with a blank page which confronts the writer, but she is also using that blank page as a symbol for a mental space which corresponds with the virtual text which narrative is to actualize. And this is quotation number 2. Who will teach me to write, a reader wanted to know. The page, that eternal blankness, the blankness of eternity which you cover slowly, affirming time's scrawl as a right and your daring as necessity. The page which you cover woodenly, ruining it, but asserting your freedom and power to act, acknowledging that you ruin everything you touch, but touching it nevertheless, because acting is better than being here in mere opacity. The page which you cover slowly with the crabbed thread of your gut, the page in the purity of its possibilities, the page of your death, against which you pit such flawed excellences as you can muster with all your life's strength, that page will teach you to write. There is another way of saying this. Aim for the chopping block. If you aim for the wood, you will have nothing. Aim past the wood. Aim through the wood. Aim for the chopping block. When McCarthy, in the Kekule essay, calls our attention to the fact that breathing is involuntary, that it is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, he uses the word autonomous wrongly, I believe, rather than the central nervous system. He calls to our attention the division between the ANS and the CNS. What exercises, in fact, bodily muscles are consciously, which bodily muscles are under conscious and unconscious control. In clinical anatomy, muscle is, with the exception of the heart, all divided into smooth muscle and striated muscle, as under a microscope, the two types appear either fluid and undivided or ridged. Striated muscles are those which are under voluntary control via the central nervous system, so all the muscles in your limbs are of this type. Smooth muscle is involuntarily controlled by the autonomic nervous system, so the contractions and peristalsis of the intestinal tract are of such a type. The philosopher Gilles Deleuze in Mille Plateau writes about these two categories, the smooth and the striated, though not with reference to clinical anatomy. Precisely because the distinction between conscious and unconscious control is complex. The relation between the two is, for Deleuze, one of double articulation. In, for example, the bladder, which is made out of smooth muscle, but largely under voluntary control. Or in the diaphragm, which consists of striated muscle, although breathing is generally autonomic. Smooth space, I quote, smooth space is constantly being translated, transversed into a striated space. Striated space is constantly being reversed, returned to a smooth space. We blink, both voluntarily and involuntarily. The upper eyelid is in fact composed of a mixture of both smooth and striated muscle. Again, I quote, the two spaces in fact exist only in mixture. So, which comes first in evolution? Smooth or striated? Conscious or unconscious? From the point of view of double articulation, it is a chicken and egg question. Passage 3. Waking from etherized surgery in Blood Meridian, the kid, and here I'd like you to be thinking about that first quotation I gave you and dissected for you. The kid is described, similar situation. In that sleep and in sleeps to follow, the judge did visit. Who would come other? A great shambling mutant, silent and serene. Whatever his antecedents, he was something wholly other than their sum. Nor was their system to divide him back into his origins, for he would not go. Whoever would seek out his history, through what unravelling of loins and ledger books, must stand at last darkened and dumb, at the shore of a void without terminus or origin, and whatever science he might bring to bear upon the dusty primal matter blowing down out of the millennia will discover no trace of any ultimate atavistic egg by which to reckon his commencing. The judge, the silent, non-linguistic symbol that enters the kid's unconscious, is a chicken without an egg, explicitly. A concept unclassifiable by evolution, because it precedes it. Such obsessions as McCarthy has taken from an evolutionary point of view will, in aesthetics terms, I believe, always produce a particular set of dispositions in literature towards metaphors, on the one hand, morphogenesis, and on the other, atrophy. The doubled articulation of Darwinian biological on the one hand, and Lamarckian cultural and linguistic evolution, on the other hand, is a feedback loop. Another chicken, another egg, another chicken, und so weiter. When McCarthy draws on evolutionary metaphors himself, the tendency is plain. Quotation 4, from the road. The last instance of a thing takes the class with it, turns out the light and is gone. Look around you. Ever is a long time. But the boy knew what he knew, that ever is no time at all. connecting Julius with your previous Delander-like invocations of very, very long geological timescales. The last instance of a thing takes the class with it, a particular evolutionary classificatory term. The class might disappear with the last member, but not the phylum. To give you an example, mammals, but not chordata, or the subphylum, vertebrae. Writing might disappear, by analogy, but not the symbolic order. Quotation 5. The road again, much later in the novel. They passed through towns that warned people away with messages scrawled on the billboards. The billboards had been whited out with thin coats of paint in order to write on them, and through the paint could be seen a pale palimpsest of advertisements for goods that no longer existed. It is one of the few funny moments in the road. Advertisements for goods that no longer existed. These humans. In poetic terms, synecdoche, metaphor, metonym, whole apparatus of systems of substitution of something for the class to which it belongs, is hence replaced in McCarthy's poetics with what Donald Davey, in his book The Purity of Diction in English Verse, describes as purification in literature. What's it mean to purify the dialect, to purify language? Davey says what that means in practical terms is the revitalization of dead metaphors. It's my contention that McCarthy's visual and linguistic aesthetics are a direct consequence of this little chain of obsessions that I've just outlined. I should probably bring things to an end there, shouldn't I?
We'll work,
yeah. Okay. We will turn it to questions.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Well, thank you very much. So, to sort of saddle a horse from the back, when you talk about the purification of language and the reification almost of the dead metaphor, and Julius, you're going to have to listen to this. Can you link that to what Julius earlier said about the purification of metal in alchemy and about the link between alchemy and sort of your feedback loop? Is there something to be linked?
Yeah, there definitely is, but it only occurred to me when listening to Julius and hearing him mention purification in that particular context. And I could try and think it through right now.
Mm.
I don't think I can. I think it will be a complex task. I think there is an analogy to be drawn there. Davey is, of course, in his book, he's writing immediately post-war. He's one of those English poetry scholars who returned from the war with his beliefs in society completely destroyed, and was working in universities in the 1950s, kind of rebuilding through his work a set of values that he felt to have been kind of just exploded. He is mainly concerned with neoclassical poetry, though he does come up to questions of modernists and particularly imagists like T. Hume. He writes about Pound. He considers Eliot a little bit. And it's the phrase to purify the dialect of the tribe is T.S. Eliot's phrase. His book is very much an answer to what it might mean to purify the dialect of the tribe. Is it, on the one hand, a falling into, and he's very alert to fascism, Is it, on the one hand, a falling into purification of language in a negative, elitist, fascistic sense? And his book is an attempt to answer the ways in which, no, there are other ways of purifying language, which poets sometimes do, which are virtuous and noble ways of purifying language, which do not fall into this dreadful trap. And the Sector on Dead Metaphors is only 5 pages. It's only one of many different ways in which he talks about purification. Mm. How is one to analogize that with the purifications of alchemy? I might, Julius, come back at you with not an answer, but
More questions.
I might just dig the pit deeper and say that there is a further purification to be invoked here, which is a spiritual purification. Purification through grace, through prayer. Prayer, that is conversation with other entities or conversation with the self, depending on your point of view, which can bring a benediction or a blessing. These things seem to me to be tied together, not in the essay, not in the Kekule essay, though I think a number of us have spotted kind of gaps in that essay that can be filled by reading the fictions, where some kind of mythic connection is drawn between alchemy, language, and benediction or grace, whatever that might mean. Were I to point to one section, I don't have it bookmarked at the moment, but there's a section in Blood Meridian which is specifically about smithing and the pouring of metals and the graving of burins and the possibility of coining false coinage. And there's a distinction to be made between false coinage and true coinage. This is very much, you know, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar and unto God that which is God's. There's something going on about false and true coinage that is melding the spiritual with the smelting of metals. And I know that's just making it worse. I...